Many of you know that I'm a fan of The Lord of the Rings. I probably read it first when I was about 10 years old. And I remember part of reading it, it's this fantastical story, the peoples of free peoples of Middle-earth battling against Sauron, the enemy, and just in a quest to destroy the One Ring. And there's this great story. But if you've ever read The Lord of the Rings or Tolkien, as you go through the story, every once in a while the characters start singing. Or there's some song that comes in there. And I know the first couple times I read through that book, I was like, I don't want a song, and I just kind of skip it. I want to know what's going on in the story. I want to move forward with the story. And I was thinking about that because I think I do that sometimes with the Bible, and maybe you do too. Not necessarily that we skip those parts, but maybe in the midst of a story, there's a poem or there's a prayer, and it feels a little less important. Like, oh yeah, that's nice to know. They prayed, they sang a song, but I want to know what happens in the story. And sometimes when we do that, I think we miss something important. And so the passage Aaron read today is one of those poems or a prayer or a song from a woman named Hannah in the midst of a book called 1 Samuel. And 1 Samuel is this book that's filled with all kinds of great stories. And so sometimes we get to a prayer or poem and it's like, oh, I want to know what's going on next in the story. 1 Samuel has stories like David and Goliath, and these fantastic stories that we love to hear. But when we miss the poems or we skip over them or we move past them quickly and think, well, they're not important, we miss something. And in particular, this one. Because this poem, this song, this prayer of Hannah really kind of sets up the themes of 1 and 2 Samuel. So we're in a series called Immersed Kingdoms. And Immersed Kingdoms is a look at several books of the Bible. So Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 and 2 Samuel, and 1 and 2 Kings. And we're reading big chunks of those each week and looking at them. 1 and 2 Samuel is really one book. It's all one story meant to be read together. It's kind of broken up just going back in history because of the nature of scrolls and the way things were written. They couldn't put it all in one thing, and so it was broken up. But it's one story, and so we're in the midst of this. But if we pay attention to what Hannah prays here, we'll see a big picture of what these books are. We'll catch themes, and it'll help us read the rest of it better. And in particular, it talks about like what should it look like to have a king and what should the king look like? And I think what we'll see when we look at this a little bit more is that it's not just going to give us more Bible knowledge. Because sometimes it's tempting to walk away from a sermon, even sometimes tempting to preach a sermon and simply want to impart more knowledge. To walk out, well, I know a little bit more. I understand something better. But the goal is also that we know God better and understand who he is and what he's saying. So first, I want to look a little bit where we are in the big story and then narrow down in what that is. So we're going to look back and we're going to jump ahead a little bit. And like I said, 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel have lots of great stories in them. But today, I want to see the big picture. And so the big picture is God has chosen a people. And those people are the nation of Israel. They were in slavery in Egypt. He brought them out of slavery. And he's led them to this land of promise, or what's called the Promised Land. It's called that because centuries before, God had told a man named Abraham that he was going to make him into a great nation. And he was going to give him a land in which to live. And in that land would be a place where they could rest, but also a land out of which they could be God's people and show the rest of the world what God was like. And so after God rescues them out of slavery, he brings them to this land. And under the leadership of a man named Joshua, they begin to occupy the land. There's lots of falters along the way. And after Joshua passes away, the book of Judges tells the story of how they're struggling. And their main struggle is dealing with the nations around them, that these nations are caught up in idolatry of worshiping other gods and the tendency to fall back. And every once in a while, God raises up a leader and he leads them for a little while, but they keep falling back into the same thing. And so 1 and 2 Samuel picks up right after that. And the nation's struggling a little bit. And early on, a little bit after the story that we're going to look at, the people of Israel come to one of their leaders, a man named Samuel, and say, we want a king. We want to be like all the other nations. They're looking around at all the nations around them, and they all have a king. Israel doesn't have a human king. They know God is their king, but they want somebody to lead them. They want somebody to help them look like the other nations. They want somebody who can lead them in battle. They want conformity. They want security. So they're looking around, and they say, we want a king. To which God responds, this is a rejection. You're rejecting me by choosing a king. Because he had warned them that by asking for a king, they would reject his rule. They were, in some sense, and they were choosing their own way. God had said, I'm your king. And they said, well, we want our own king. And so he's saying, you're rejecting me because you're choosing your own way. And he warned them of the consequences. You can read about those in 1 Samuel 8 of what will happen. But I like one scholar, Stephen Dempster, summarizes essentially, here's what happens when they choose a king. The king they want will always be on the take rather than a giver. He will take sons for soldiers, daughters for servants, seed, fields, vineyards, and household servants. In other words, you can have a king, but the king isn't going to give you. The king is going to be taking things from you. He's going to turn you into your soldiers, into your sons into soldiers, and your daughters into servants. He's going to be waging war, and he's always going to be taxing you and taking money from you to do these wars. And so this is kind of the setting of what's going on. And then later on, we meet the first two kings. We meet Saul. Those names that begin with S, all these kind of blur together. So he's going to first king Saul and then a king David. And so we're going to see the contrast between these first two kings. So these books, 1 and 2 Samuel, is going to focus on just two kings, Saul and David. And we're going to see the contrast between those two kings and what the ideal king should look like. And so that's where we come back to Hannah. So let's go back to the start of 1 Samuel. So this is big picture. People in the land, they're struggling. They're looking around the nation for him. And we enter into this story with a man named Elkanah. And Elkanah has two wives, Peninnah and Hannah, or Hannah. And the key point of that story is Hannah doesn't have any children. And so she goes and she's praying for a child. And she goes to the temple to pray. And she says to God, if you give me a child, I will give this child to the Lord. In other words, I will dedicate him to your service. He won't be at home taking care of me. He won't be home working in the fields. He will serve you all of his life. And God answers that prayer. And so when her son named Samuel was born, she takes him when he's really young, probably 2-3 years old. She takes him to the temple and gives him into service. And then at that moment, as she takes him in, that's where this prayer or this song of Hannah that we heard just a little while ago read. And so it kind of takes this big picture of what's going on. And so I describe it as a song. It's often described that way. It's described in the scripture as a prayer. We see the poem, but it feels like a song she's singing. And what she's getting at is she moves from herself to like big picture. And one of the key ideas I want us to pay attention to is when she's praying, when she's describing, she's talking about a God who delivers and brings great reversal. That this is a God that we serve, that Yahweh is a God who brings rescue, and he does it, and he reverses the course of things. He reverses history. He reverses situations. And all that relates to the kind of king they want. So we're going to go back. 1 Samuel 2:1, it says, then Hannah prayed, my heart rejoices in the Lord. The Lord has made me strong. Now I have an answer for my enemies. I rejoice because you rescued me. And so you hear her, she's starting at a personal level. Like, my heart rejoices. The Lord has made me strong. I have an answer for my enemies. Her enemy, who was her enemy? Peninnah, the other wife, because when she was unable to have a child, the other wife was kind of rubbing her face in it. And so here's what I say, I rejoice because you rescued me. And it talks about like, you have made me strong, or some translations are like, your horn has been lifted high. And that's essentially a picture of when you think of animals and the horns on an animal is a symbol of their strength. And so when maybe two rams go into battle, the one who lifts its head at the end is the victor. And so lifting the horn high is a sign of victory. And so this picture begins to arise here as Hannah's painting the picture. It's like, God is the one who delivers. And we know in part this is a theme for these books because at the very end, so I said, 1 and 2 Samuel are really one book. At the end of 2, what we call 2 Samuel, David, remember those one of those first two kings, is looking back on what his life was like. And he says this in 2 Samuel 22:2. He sang, that is David, the Lord is my rock, my fortress, and my savior. My God is my rock in whom I find protection. He is my shield, the power that saves me in my place of safety. He is my refuge, my savior, the one who saves me from violence. I called on the Lord, who is worthy of praise, and he saved me from my enemies. Which sounds a whole lot like what Hannah just said in that beginning. So we hear Hannah starting off, beginning of 1 Samuel, God save me from my enemies. And David looks back many years later over his career and says, God, save me from my enemies. And so we kind of see these bookends. We say, oh, 1 and 2 Samuel must have something to do with God saving us from our enemies. And part of it is this idea that the king and the people are to trust in God alone as the one who can deliver. So 1 Samuel 2:9, this is, again, part of Hannah's prayer. He will protect his faithful ones, but the wicked will disappear in darkness. No one will succeed by strength alone. And so it's going back and saying that the only way to succeed is through God. And he's the one who can deliver. So we start to get that picture in our mind. Who can save us? God. But the people of Israel, when they were looking around, what were they asking for? They said, we want a king. Well, why did they want a king? Because they saw all the other nations had kings. And what was one of the main jobs of the king? To lead in battle. In other words, to bring victory. And so Hannah, in her prayer, is starting to set up this thing, this idea, this concept to say, don't look to the king. Don't look for something else. You have to keep your eye on where deliverance comes from. You have to keep your eye on where victory comes from. And it comes from God alone. And she describes victory or deliverance in part as a reversal of fortune. So she goes on. This is Hannah's part of Hannah's prayer. The bow of the mighty is now broken, and those who stumbled are now strong. Those who are well fed are now starving. And so we see this, you know, the fed become starving, and those who are starving are now full. The childless woman now has 7 children. Somebody's lifted up, and the woman with many children wastes away. The Lord gives both death and life. He brings some down to the grave, but raises others up. The Lord makes some poor and others rich. He brings some down and lifts others up. He lifts the poor from the dust and the needy from the garbage dump. He sets them among princes, placing them in seats of honor. So he goes down to the scrap heap where the people are digging through the dumpsters. He takes the dumpster divers and makes them into princes and puts them in seats of honor. For all the earth is the Lord, and he has set the world in order. So we see this picture starting to arrive that this is what it is, that fortune is reversed, that those who are down are lifted up, that those who are brought down or lifted itself. And so he's contrasting it. But who's doing the lifting up? God is. And so there's an interesting phrase. It doesn't show up real well in a lot of the translations. In verse 3, many of the translations say something like, stop acting so proud and haughty, or stop boasting. The Hebrew simply says something like, stop saying tall, tall. That word tall, in other words, tall, which is a way of saying you're both, which is interesting because that idea of being tall is going to be a significant theme in 1 and 2 Samuel. We'll see the ones who are tall, who look like they're mighty, are brought down, and the ones who are insignificant looking are raised up. And so Hannah says, oh, stop saying tall, tall, and we don't catch it there, but there's this picture of what it's looked like. And so part of that other idea is that fortunes are reversed, but we have to be careful about judging by appearances. And so here's where we set it up. And so this is, we're going to take a quick run through 1 and 2, particularly 1 Samuel, and see some of these things. So where's the big picture at? Big picture right now is, who can deliver? God and God alone. God is the one who delivers. He's the only one who can rescue, and he does it by reversing fortunes, by turning things upside down, and he implies that there are upside down values. So some of the stories that we see this. So remember, Hannah prays, she has a little boy named Samuel. And that little boy is raised by the priest. And so you're expecting this young little boy, if God is going to come and speak to someone, who do you think God would talk to? A little 8-year-old boy or a priest? Most of us probably say, well, God would talk to the priest. I mean, that was God's normal way of communication. He would talk through the priest. That was how the priests were set up. They were to be the ones who were to receive God's word, the prophets. But God doesn't talk to the priest. He talks to the little boy. We start to see the reversal of fortune. That's in chapter 3 of 1 Samuel. Chapter 4 of 1 Samuel, we see these priests, this same priest, along with his sons, carrying the ark into battle. The ark of the covenant was this big box that contained the Ten Commandments and these other things. It was a symbol of God's power and God's presence. Thing was, God hadn't told them to do that yet. So they think, well, look, we've got the magic box. We've got God's power. We can take it with us and win the battle. Any guesses what happens in that battle? they get defeated because they didn't do what God had said. In fact, at the end of the battle, Eli, that one priest who God didn't talk to, he falls over, breaks his neck, and he's dead. Great stories, aren't they? But do we see the high being brought down? And then at the end of the battle, so the Israelites are defeated by the Philistines. The ark, God's presence, is captured, which feels like, for the people of Israel, it could be a crisis. Because what are we going to do? The ark is captured. God's presence is now in the hands of the enemy. And so the Philistines take the ark and they put it in their own temple with their god Dagon. And there's this whole great story where they put the ark in the temple, and every time they come in the temple, like, Dagon's little idol statue is like laying on the floor. And I kind of imagine almost like, well, how does that happen? I think God reached down and like, tink, knocks the idol over. And eventually the idol falls and breaks its neck. And the Philistines are like, we can't have this anymore. We're going to send the ark back. Plus all of our people, we've got rats running around and we've got people with tumors. And so there's this like strange story about like when they send the ark back to the Israelites, they're like, oh, we need to repay them. So we're going to send them some gold mice and gold rats and gold tumors. And I was wondering, what does a gold tumor look like? I mean, we got to admit the Bible is weird sometimes, okay? And it doesn't always make sense. And we don't have to understand every little detail. But what do we see in that midst of that really weird and crazy story? Who rescued the ark? God did. God didn't need any help. God was the one who makes the Philistines return the ark. He's not overpowered by the other gods. In other words, God is the one who delivers. Or we'll go back to the story I mentioned earlier, chapter 8, the people want a king. And Samuel, this priest, this little boy now, has grown up and he anoints Saul, which means he puts oil. It's a symbol of God's presence. And he says to the people, here is your king. And we find Saul, he's off hiding over in the luggage somewhere. But if you read the story, one of the details told about Saul, we don't know what color his eyes are, what color his hair is. We can take some guesses on that. We no appearance of what he looks like. But we're told one thing about him. He stands a head above everybody else. In other words, he is tall. And we just heard that word, didn't we? Back when Hannah said, don't say tall, tall, because the tall will be brought down, which is exactly what happens to Saul. Saul later on, he does pretty well at first. I mean, he starts off good, but then he disobeys God. And Samuel has a lot of great stories. Another great story, God tells him, when this battle is over, I want you to slaughter all the animals. And there was another one that was like, what's that all about? But pay attention to what happens in the story. Saul is given a command by God. When you defeat the Ammonites, I want you to take and I want you to slaughter all the animals. Well, they defeat him. And then he looks around, he says, those are some good looking animals. I mean, those would make some good barbecue. So let's hang on to those. And so Samuel, the prophet, shows up. And he looks at Saul, he says, Saul, why did you disobey God? Saul says, what are you talking about? Samuel says, don't you hear the bleating of the sheep? I hear the moos and the baas. You did not do what God had told you to do. He does his only thing. He does his own thing. He forgets that God alone is king, that he is only a servant. And then it goes on. And so God tells Samuel, the priest at this point, that Saul's not going to cut it as king. He's not listening. And so we need a new king. And so I want you to go to this other family, and I'm going to show you who will be king. So there's a whole story goes where Samuel goes to anoint a new king. And he goes to this farmer, and he brings out all his sons, and he keeps looking at him. He's like, oh, that guy looks good. That guy looks strong. Oh, he'd be the great, you know, he'd look good on TV. We need him as the king. And then he looks, but there's nobody there. And God keeps telling Samuel, no, not him, not him, not him. And finally, Samuel says to Jesse, he says, well, is there anybody else? He's like, yeah, I got my little kid. He's out in the field, but he's not king material, I can tell you that. I mean, even his dad doesn't think he's worth it, but this boy, anybody know his name? David. Yeah, we could say only a boy named David, right? But yeah, so there's a boy, and he goes out, and this is what it says. When they arrived, Samuel took one look at Eliab and thought, surely this is the Lord's anointed. That's the first of the sons. He says, but the Lord said to Samuel, don't judge by his appearance or his height. His tallness, exactly. For I have rejected him. The Lord doesn't see things the way you see them. People judge by outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. So we again see what? The reversal of how God works. That God doesn't work in expected ways. One more story about David. As we're seeing these themes, and they're all tying back to exactly what Hannah has said. The other story is that one we're most maybe familiar with if we know the story of David. Where David goes out, the Israelites are fighting the Philistines. The Philistines sent out this giant named Goliath. And there's this whole thing that goes back and forth. And finally, David goes out to meet Goliath on the battle. And there's this reversal because here's the little boy and here's the giant. But listen to what David says. David replied to the Philistine, you come to me with sword, spear, and javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of heaven's army, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. Today the Lord will conquer you. He doesn't say what? He doesn't say, I'm going to beat you. He says what? The Lord will conquer you. And I will kill you and cut off your head. And then I will give the dead bodies of your men to the birds and wild animals. And the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. And everyone assembled here will know that the Lord rescues his people. Which is exactly what Hannah talked about. That who is the one who delivers? It's God. And what David said when he looked back on his whole life, who is the one who delivers? It's God. And he will rescue, but not with sword and spear. This is the Lord's battle. So do you see in these stories, do you see Hannah's prayer? Hannah's song is telling us that the king that Israel needs, the king that they need is one who will trust in God for deliverance. That's the kind of king they need. They don't need a masterful general. They don't need a big guy who's a mighty warrior. They don't need a finance expert. They don't need someone who's into management and knows how to work strength finders with all his cabinet members and make everything work right. What they need is a king who will do one thing. Trust God. And trust that God is the one who will bring deliverance. And that king also needs to recognize that God operates by different standards. That what it looks like on the outside is not necessarily what's going on the inside. That God takes the lowly and lifts them up and takes those who are up and puts them down. And you say, okay, that's great. That was way back then. That was the king that they needed. That was the king, and that was Hannah's prayer, and that's what happened in 1 2 Samuel. But doesn't have anything to do with us here, sitting here on 2025 at Fruitland. Yes or no? Yes, it does. But I also want us to be careful to like not go there too quickly. And this is simply Pastor Carl's thoughts on reading our Bible. Sometimes we're in a hurry to read our Bibles and say, what does it say to me? And we need to stop and just read for a while and just say, what is it saying? And what is it saying about who God is? And then maybe we get to the point of like, what does it say to us? And so I think we can take a couple things away. And one is that theme that Hannah has introduced to you, that God, the God we love and serve, is a God who reverses fortunes. That he sees those who are left out, that he sees those that are run down, and God can turn things around, that he can use the unexpected and do different things. We celebrated that very thing just a couple weeks ago. We celebrated Easter, and Easter is this celebration where we remember Jesus' death on a cross, which looks like defeat. We see Jesus hung on a cross, crucified, shamed, apparently defeated as he's put in a grave. But what does God do? He turns it around. He says, now what looked like defeat is actually victory. You see, because when Jesus was on a cross, it looked like defeat, but he was on the throne. And when God, when he is placed in the ground, then God raises him up and seats him at the right hand. And so the story of Christianity, not just the story of 1 Samuel, but the story of how God works, is he turns things around and he takes what looks like weakness. What looked like Jesus' weakness on the cross, what looked like his defeat, was actually his victory over the powers of death, sin, and the devil. And so it's at that big picture, but it's also in our own lives. It's also our own lives of remembering how God can take what looks like bad and can turn it into good. But also how God can reverse our fortunes. When we're struggling, when we're down, God can lift us up and bring us out. And so what we want to remember is when we're in those situations that God can turn things around. We sang those songs, you know, mover of mountains, breaker of chains, that when we're in those places, God can over, and God is the deliverer. And we sang the song, remember the, how the song went on? What, nothing can stop our God. And that's what's going on in these books where we see the ark is captured. It's held in an enemy temple. But nothing can stop God because he rescues himself. And so we think about that, how God reverses, but it also helps us think about how God evaluates. And likewise, how do we? Do we look at the outward appearance? Yeah, because in part, that's all we can see, right? And in some sense, when we look at somebody, what we can see is on the outside, but what we want to pay attention to also is what's their character? What's going on the inside? Do we simply look for the outward strength and the appearance or the strong man? Because what it's getting at is that human strength doesn't guarantee victory. There is something more. There's something more going on. And so maybe it's an invitation to us when we're going through life. Maybe it's an individual we meet. And we start to say, well, I don't know if God really can do much with them. And we need to stop and remember these stories. Stop and remember when God says, I don't judge by the appearances, but I judge what's in the heart. Remember these stories and so many other ones where the person who seemed the least likely is the one who God uses to do incredible things. And so maybe it's a reminder for me and for all of us that when we look at an individual to say, well, I'm not sure. I think God, I don't know if that's really for you. But to say God can do amazing, surprising things. Or maybe it's looking at something bigger, looking at a church or an organization or a ministry and saying, well, that's just a small ministry. I don't know if God, and to realize God can do amazing things with the small. And sometimes we look at what's big and what's flashy, what's going on. And sometimes God does use the big, but he also can use the small. And it's not our responsibility to see that. And so we go on and we see that those things don't guarantee victory. But instead, he says, where it talks about it, this is the end of Hannah's prayer. He gives prayer to his king. He increases the strength of his anointed one. And this is interesting. This is the first time this phrase, his anointed one, is used to talk about Israel's king. And the Hebrew word for anointed one is Messiah, which in Greek is Christos or Christ, which we associate with someone named Jesus. And so here is this picture, and what we begin to see in this story is, and where it connects to us also to, is this story running through the Bible. That Israel, God's people, are longing for a righteous king. They're longing for the ideal anointed one, the ideal Messiah, the ideal Christ who will deliver them. And we see in the story, as the story begins, David seems like that guy. He seems like the one that he's going to be the ideal anointed one. In some ways, he holds that picture, but you read the stories and David's got some problems too. And he doesn't always do what God asks. And so what happens in the story is we're encouraged to look beyond that story. Say, where is this ideal king? Where is the anointed one that God is going to send us? Which brings us to Jesus. And we have to be careful because this can sometimes feel like the simply more like, oh, of course the answer is Jesus, right? It can be like, oh, if we don't know what it is, then we talk about Jesus or twisting it to be about Jesus. But it's clear here in this one where that's what's going on because Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the anointed one. Images of Jesus as king. He is the king we need. And so in part, what this prayer of Hannah is pointing us to is the ultimate king that we need, who is Jesus, who I just mentioned a few guys. What does Jesus demonstrate in his life? The reversal of fortune, where he takes death and he turns it into life, but also in his own ministry. How many times did he look at people and he said, the first shall be last and the last shall be first. The humble shall be exalted and those who exalt themselves shall be humbled, which sounds a whole lot like what Hannah prayed. Because it wasn't just a random song or prayer that we skip over to get to the good parts about giants and rat tumors and things like that. But it's a story that tells us this is what God is like. God reverses fortunes. God lifts up the lowly and brings down those who exalt themselves. And we see it most of all in Jesus, who turns out to be the ideal king, who turns out to be exactly the one that God gives to us. He's the king who reverses the fortune and inaugurates an upside-down kingdom. So today, as we kind of wrap up this story, we can ask ourselves, and maybe you could ask yourself, is there something in your life, is there some fortune in your life, is there something going on that you need your fortunes reversed? Where you've been brought down, where there's a struggle, where there's a battle, where there's something going on in your life. If so, and I think the invitation from this is to do what Hannah did, to pray. Say, God, you are the God who reverses and brings life out of death, who brings victory out of defeat. And so we offer up our prayers to God as the one who do that. Or maybe you're one who those prayers have been answered. Maybe you're on the other side of that and your prayers have been answered. Your fortunes have been reversed. That thing that looked like victory, that situation that looked like darkness has been turned to light. And then you can do what Hannah does and what so many others do. You sing. You celebrate. You say, this is a good thing. And so like Hannah celebrated, we too can celebrate. That's what we do. That's one of the reasons we sing. I talk about this. One of the reasons we sing is we celebrate. Easter was a few weeks ago, but we can still celebrate that today. We still celebrate today that Jesus brought victory out of death. That this thing that looked like the end was really the beginning. That in Jesus, our sins are forgiven. That we have the opportunity for new life. That in Jesus, the Spirit comes in and reverses our life and begin to change us. All because he reversed our fortunes. He turned things around. The one who can deliver. We couldn't do any of that ourselves. But like Hannah said, like David said when he looked back, there's only one who can deliver, and that's God. There's only one who can deliver, and that's Jesus through his life, death, and resurrection and ascension. And so may we hear these words of Hannah. May they be our own prayer, to pray to God who is the one who can deliver, to pray to God who is the only one who can deliver. And may we see our lives turned around and changed. May we see the world in which we live turned around and changed by the one God who alone can bring deliverance, the one God who can rescue. Amen.